This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. My name's Andy Boyd. My guest today on the program is Marianne Worthington, author of the book The Girl Singer, which is a collection of poems. Marianne, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Andy. I'm glad to be here.
So I really enjoyed this book, and I read some contemporary poetry, but it's not my sort of primary genre. I guess my question is, how common is it to have a book of poems that is kind of it almost reminded me of a song cycle on an album or something, that these poems are all kind of about similar themes and topics. Is that very common? Is this the first time you've done something like that?
It is the first time that I've done something like this, and I'm not sure how common it is, although the connections between poetry and singing and song, I think, are very, very close. So maybe even a poet will think about the musical qualities of language as she or he is writing without necessarily writing about music per se.
Mm-hmm. What's your history with kind of folk music, country music, traditional music? I don't know what terminology you use, but what's your past with that genre?
I think the terms that we use just depend on what we heard growing up or how we've been schooled to think about music. But for me, primarily, I had parents who were very avid music listeners, but they listened primarily to either folk music, which would have been, when I was coming up, would have been Peter, Paul, and Mary. Even Bob Dylan was considered, you know, a folk singer in the early days. Or they listened to straight up country music on the radio. We were a working class family, so we didn't have a lot of extra money, but my mother was a seamstress, and I know that she used some of the money that she made from sewing to buy record albums. We did have stereo. So one of the first records I ever remember hearing was Doc Watson's debut recording from Vanguard Records, who was a North Carolina folk singer. And then we also went to church. And lucky for me, about the only thing that remains in my church upbringing is music. I had a wonderful and beautiful music teacher in the church who taught us a lot about music and hymnody. And I think I probably learned to read by looking so much at the hymn book when I was a child. So those two things, you know, popular music and sacred music, were in me from the very beginning. I also took piano lessons from the time I was 6 until I was, you know, 18 or 19.
Mm-hmm. Was that also kind of how you got into poetry? I mean, there's a lot of great poetry in those old traditional songs.
Yes, there surely is. I can't say that that's how I got into poetry, but it's something, the hymnody and the hymn book and the poetry of hymns has stayed with me, and it's something that can never be erased from me, even though a lot of the doctrine from my early church upbringing has disappeared. But I can't say that it made me be a poet. I'm a late bloomer. I didn't go to college until I was 27. I worked right out of high school for almost a decade. And I studied writing in college, but it was not my major. And it wasn't until we moved to Kentucky in 1990 that I found a real lively and vibrant literary community. And that's when I really started writing poetry seriously.
Interesting. So this book is, as I said, kind of largely based on the idea of women in folk and country music,
right?
As the title would indicate. Did you have to do a lot of research about that? Or was this kind of something that you knew well enough that you could just kind of pick up a pen and write these poems?
Some of it was intuitive because, as I said, my parents were great listeners to country music, and they knew a lot about country music, even though they didn't do anything but pay really good attention to what they heard on the radio and what they heard DJ say and what they saw on television. So some of it I learned from them. But yes, I did spend a lot of time doing some research. I was lucky to get a fellowship at Berea College in Berea, Kentucky, in their special collections archives, where they house all kinds of sound archives. So they had all of these early radio show music broadcasts. They had letters and books and all kinds of really great sort of secret things about particular performers. So it was wonderful. I spent a month at the library with that fellowship. So every day during it was June, I would go into the library and just spend all day in the library, you know, until they closed. It was great. So, and also just reading, you know, reading about country music. And I had written about country music in an academic way by going to conferences and things like that. And so I had some book learning too, but so some of it was intuitive and some of it was purposefully sought out through research. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to read the poem, The Girl Singer, the title poem from the collection?
Sure, I'd be glad to. So The Girl Singer is kind of a composite of women that I saw growing up performing on television, but also it's sort of the story of a woman who wants to be this singer, but she has all this knowledge about how she is just a girl singer, which was kind of the way that men treated women in the business. You know, they were the stars, and then they had a, quote, girl singer, unquote, as kind of a sidekick, you know, who was a part of the show, but not the headliner. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an amalgamation of that. And also, if you know your murder ballads, you'll recognize several lyrics from murder ballads in this poem. So this is The Girl Singer. How hard it was to hold my body against defeat and come to be known as just a girl singer by those men who said, "We're doing you a big favor, honey." Once I sang the lonely songs I loved. The A minor chord on my black Gibson hummed lonesome as a grave. I strummed right through their promises, crying, "Oh, the dreadful wind and the rain." On stage, I was one notch below the gap-toothed hayseed in his checkered jacket and short pants, clowning around with me as his sidekick, and we'd laugh and laugh. "I dug on your grave the better part of last night." Too sorrowful, they said, the bosses. Heard enough about sick-hearted boys chasing aggravated beauties, poor orphan children dropping and dying in the snow. War was over, they said. Be old-fashioned, but not too much. How hard it was to fetch my voice for chirpier songs. Oh, the cuckoo, she never hollers cuckoo. I wore down. I mourned the women killed in all the murder ballads I knew, bludgeoned, stabbed, drowned, floated downstream to the Miller's Cove. He made fiddle screws from her little finger bones. I had to quit singing our songs. Her clothes all wet and muddy, they laid her on a plank.
Great. Thank you so much. That was wonderful.
Thank you.
We were talking about the poetry in some of those old songs, and you know, our listeners won't have the printed poem in front of them, so they won't know. You italicized the quotations,
right?
And that line, "He made fiddle screws from her little finger bones," is from one of the murder ballads, and that is
such a
chilling line.
Yeah, the whole song is actually quite chilling. It's called "Oh, the Dreadful Wind and the Rain," and so what happens is one sister kills another and throws her in the river, and she floats downstream to the Miller's Cove, and he pulls her out of the water, and he actually makes a fiddle from her body. You know, her rib cage becomes the body of the fiddle, and he uses her hair to make the strings, and then he made fiddle screws from her little finger bones. Yeah, it's really creepy. Yeah.
But it's also, I mean, I don't know how much this is the original intention, but certainly as you appropriate that line, it becomes a line about the ways that women are instrumentalized in country music and basically treated like an instrument rather than like a creator.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm glad you picked up on that, because that was certainly the intention. Thank you.
Yeah. I almost feel like if I were a poet, I wouldn't want to quote a line that's that good. I don't know that I'd want to follow that, but I think you effectively kind of weave it into what you're doing.
Thank you.
So, yeah, I mean, we could probably talk for the whole time about sexism in country music. I don't necessarily think we should, but I feel like we should address it, that this is not just something in the past tense, that something like 85% of singers on country radio are still men. Despite the fact that I think when a lot of people think of country music, they think of Dolly Parton, they think of Shania Twain, they think of Emmylou Harris. It's not like there's a dearth of, you know, fantastic women artists in the genre, but they're just still not given their due.
Right.
Why do you think that? I mean, obviously that gender division used to be as strong in a lot of genres, but it seems like it's persisted that way in country music. Why do you think that is?
I'm not sure I know, other than to say I think that's just how our structure is built. I think systemic patriarchy is just part of the system, and that, you know, men were always granted the power to be the managers and the caretakers and the people who ran the shows, and not a lot of women were able to do that. I mean, if you think about Dolly Parton and the fact that she was Porter Wagoner's quote girl singer, you know, for many years, and when she wanted to have more control over her own career and her own destiny, he just did everything he could think of to try to get her to stay. And part of that, I think, is because he knew he was not going to be so popular without Dolly Parton, you know. And so people like Dolly Parton and even Loretta Lynn, who had some control in the studio, and even Patsy Cline, who didn't have a lot of control in the studio, but complained loudly about not having a lot of control in the studio. Mm-hmm. You know, those were the women who sort of paved the way for women today. And also, I just think this, oh, and I should say also, Andy, that I kind of have a really, conservative view of country music, in the fact that I don't really consider country music much past 1975. I don't listen to country music on the radio because I don't care for that bro country and all those hats and, you know, and all that. But you're right. I mean, it is women have had to fight, and they're still fighting, you know.
Yeah.
I think we see that too in the fact that there are less Black people and people of color in country music. Now that is changing with, you know, stars like
Mickey Guyton.
Mickey Guyton and Rhiannon Giddens and Amethyst Key and Valerie June and Yola and, you know, some of those. Brittany Spencer is another one, Miko Marks. But there weren't a lot of Black people and people of color in early country music either.
I recently watched a documentary about these questions in country music. And one of the things that it pointed out is that even when Black people have made country music in the past, it's often not thought of as country music. So even Ray Charles with Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music, it was not played on country radio, which is absurd to me.
But, exactly. And you know, the truth is that a lot of country music, like a lot of popular music, no matter the genre, was taken from Black people, stolen and appropriated and used. The banjos, the prime example, an instrument that came from Africa, you know. So one of the artists that I admire the most that's working today is Rhiannon Giddens, because she has that teaching artist quality where she will say to an audience, here's the roots of this song, and let me tell you, it comes from Black people, you know. So that's an aspect of country music that is not pretty. So the sexism, the racism in country music is something that I really struggle with.
It's also ironic too that it seems like what is called sort of alternative country is in some ways closer to what country music was before 1975 than what actually gets played on country music radio. Like if you want to hear somebody who's, you know, seriously engaging with the legacy of someone like Hank Williams, you're not going to find that on the mainstream country stations.
That's exactly right. You know, and that's one of the reasons why Emmylou Harris, I think, has always been so important to me and so popular to me is that she taught all of us how to go back and find the original artist for all those songs that she recorded. I remember being in the car with my father in 1973 and Emmylou Harris's first song came on the radio, If I Could Only Win Your Love. And my father and I always listened to country music together when we were in the car. We'd never heard this song. And my father said to me, who is that woman singing that old Louvin Brothers song? And I said, who are the Louvin Brothers? You know, so you're right. I think alternative country or Americana music is much closer to old style country music than what we hear on popular country music radio today. Absolutely.
You have a poem about the great folk singer Hazel Dickens, who is also known as an activist and a quite outspoken, you know, left wing pro worker, pro labor activist. In that poem, are you partially trying to sort of remind readers that Appalachia, that the South has a tradition of left wing politics, and that's a, you know, maybe calling for a bit of a revival of that tradition?
Yes, absolutely. Because she was a rabble rouser and devoted her life to singing benefits at miners' rallies, you know, miners who were on strike. She sang against mining company politics. Her brothers had worked in the mines in West Virginia. And a lot of her family, when the coal mines dried up in West Virginia, a lot of her family moved to Baltimore, and that's why she moved to Baltimore. She followed her family up there, and it was getting to meet Mike Seeger, who was probably single-handedly did more to revitalize folk music in the 1960s than anybody. She became friends with him, and that's kind of how her career started. But yeah, and also, you know, the other thing about Hazel Dickens is that she's one of the first women in bluegrass music. So there's another area of offshoot of country music that didn't have a lot of women performers. And so Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard, when they made their first record together, you know, it was bluegrass music, and that was unheard of, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a history of left-wing politics and even in poetry, too. You know, Don West, who was a pretty famous union organizer, grew up in North Georgia and ended up in West Virginia. He was also known not only as a poet, but as a left-wing organizer, you know.
Would you like to read Barn Dance Roadshow next?
Sure. Sure. This is a poem about just how women had to, you know, travel with men and be kind of on their time. Barn Dance Roadshow. Hungry as she was for fame, she never thought they'd change her name or dress her up in homely cloth and make her say those scripted jokes. She never thought she'd have to ride the waves of heat all summer long to hawk the barn dance radio in close school halls and fairground tents. No one said she'd bear alone the blues, the cramps, the damp-filled nights, the silhouettes on hotel walls where her name in secret she would write in letters of bright gold. She couldn't know the sacrifice to sing the lonely song she loved would be rough travel with quarrelsome men who never guessed her given name and didn't give a damn anyway.
Great. Thank you. That poem has such a great rhythm to it when you hear it out loud. I don't know that occurred to me when I read it on the page.
Yeah. Yeah. I worked really hard to make this sort of a song poem with particular rhythm. Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm-hmm.
Is this poem about a specific singer, or is it also sort of an amalgamation of different experiences?
It is an amalgamation, but it was prompted after I read in the archives at Berea College about a singer, and I forget what her name was, Linda something. Anyway, she was at the Renfro Valley Barn Dance, and she was on tour with these men for, she was a radio star, and she had been sort of a nightclub singer, and she lived in Chicago, and she was sort of discovered and brought to Kentucky. Actually, I think she was on the National Barn Dance first, and that was in Chicago. But eventually she came to Kentucky, and the men, you know, rearranged her persona so that she was no longer a nightclub singer, but this really sweet, you know, homely woman in a bonnet who would mm-hmm. sing these, you know, songs of hearth and home. And while she was on tour, she had an attack of appendicitis, and everyone just ignored her, and she just became really sick, and her appendix burst, and she died. Mm-hmm. And so then she was sort of immortalized as this, you know, this famous barn dance singer, when in fact, you know, she'd been this nightclub singer in Chicago. Wow. It's a really interesting story. Yeah.
It's always so interesting to me how, like, the lengths people will go to manufacture a sense of authenticity.
Yes. 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 And I think that that was really important because, you know, the early barn dance radio shows, even though they were on radio, especially the National Barn Dance, which was in Chicago, but this was before the FCC had rules about how you could transmit. And so you could hear it all over the country. You could hear the National Barn Dance radio show all over the country. But even though it was a radio show, there was a live audience. So that's why the singers always dressed in costume, and why all the jokes were scripted, and why the performers had these names and why they had to look a certain way because of the live audience that, you know, would go to the shows.
So they said they had to look the part.
They had to look the part. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel like there's kind of a tension for you as a fan of this music between, you know, that we talked about that he made fiddle screws from her little finger bones, that just the real honest poetry of traditional music with that kind of, I don't know, hokey packaging that it's so often presented in?
Yes, I do struggle with that. And it's one of the reasons that I wrote the book. And I have a love-hate relationship with it. Like, I can remember being, as a child, I remember waiting on Saturday afternoons for the Porter Wagoner show to come on TV so I could see Dolly. And not only did I want to hear what song she was going to sing, and I had no idea, by the way, that she had written most of those songs, I wanted to see what she was going to wear because no woman in my life dressed like Dolly Parton, you know?
I don't think that's just your life, Marianne.
And nobody had hair like that. And I can say the same thing for Loretta Lynn, although she dressed a little bit more conservatively on the television show that she was on. But yeah, those costumes and the costumes, especially that people like Nudie, the tailor, and Manuel, his student, who's also a tailor. I think Manuel's probably still working. How they made those glittery costumes and how that caught on. You know, it was the singing cowboys who wore those costumes first, people like Roy Rogers and Dale Evans. And then in California, the Maddox Brothers and Sister Rose, which was a hillbilly band, they started wearing those costumes and then it really took off, you know. And I was in love with those costumes, hokey as they were. And part of it was because my mother made costumes for a lot of people. She made choir costumes. She sewed a lot of the costumes that the University of Tennessee majorettes wore on the field at football games.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You know, so I had that kind of experience of glitter and sparkle and all of that lavish material in my mother's living room when I was a kid. So I think that's one of the reasons why I like it. But yeah, I do struggle with that sort of hokiness and persona and the authenticity of the music and the lyrics. Yeah.
But at the same time, it seems like you're expressing that for you as like a working class kid, there was something really exciting about seeing that kind of glitz and glamour from country stars that you wouldn't have wanted to see somebody up there in, you know, overalls and a work shirt, but you know, you want to see the costumes that, you know.
Yes, yes. Although there were men who did wear overalls and work shirts as part of their costume, you know, and they had a particular persona, but you learn to recognize performers by their costumes, you know, or at least I did when I was a kid. So, yeah.
I want to talk about another aspect of your career, which is you're the co-founder of Still, which is a journal dedicated to writing from the Appalachian region.
Yes.
Could you talk about kind of how you founded that journal and kind of what you're trying to do with it? Are you trying to kind of rewrite people's received ideas about that region, or
Maybe it's less of a programmatic point.
Well, I could say that I think that was our main goal in the very beginning, is that there's still all these stereotypes about what Appalachian people are, and those stereotypes come from people who don't live in the region. Mm-hmm. Now, I will say that there is a hint of truth to every stereotype, but there still today we have so many stereotypes about the region. So one of the things that we wanted to do when we founded the magazine, and I had two other co-founders, was we wanted to feature writers, musicians, and artists who could tell their own story. Here's my story about Appalachia. Here's my story about what it means to be in Appalachia. That meant including Black voices, people of color, queer voices, trans voices. We wanted to include those because we wanted to show the complexity of the Appalachian region, not the stereotypes. So we founded it in 2009, me and two other co-founders, and we did it sitting around a kitchen table one night. You know, we said, I want to have a literary journal. Yeah, me too. Okay, let's do it. And we found a free website, and we solicited, you know, several people that we knew who were writers, and we put it up pretty quick. So yeah, that's been going on since 2009, and that's kind of our major goal. We want to celebrate diversity and the creativity of Appalachia.
Great. Would you like to read Barn Dance Chorus?
Sure. Barn Dance Chorus uses all of the names that women were given. No, I'm sorry. Wait a minute. Yes. Barn Dance Chorus uses all of the names that were given to these women performers by men. So almost every noun that you hear that is some sort of name was an actual name of an actual performer. So this is Barn Dance Chorus, and the epigraph is from musician Kathy Fink and her song title, Little Darlin's Not My Name. Barn Dance Chorus. It's not cousin, gal, honey, or sweetheart. Not little miss, little maid, little Joe, little shoe, little sunbonnet. Our names aren't sister, girl, lady, or aunt. Listen, we had to play like one of the boys, cards, drinking, jokes, to hold our own on radio, at whistle stops, barn dances, schoolhouses, church meetings, and every blazing county fair in all the states they used for our names, Montana, Louisiana, Texas. Don't call us bluebird, songbird, nightingale, cricket, not sunshine, moonshine, violet, or sugar. Not brown eyes, black-eyed Susie, Daisy, or laughing Lindy. Listen. If you want us, say the names our mothers gave us. Recall how we really were, raw-boned, standing spread-legged while we headlined those mean stages.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, that's wonderful. I feel like one of the things that this poem brings out that's maybe implicit in some of the other ones you've read is just that double standard between you have to be, you know, when you're on stage, you have to be sweet little Miss Sunbonnet, and yet they also had to be tough. I mean, Loretta Lynn was a tough woman, is a tough woman, you know, right. Dolly Parton's a tough woman. Hazel Dickens is a tough woman. So I feel like that's really in there. The idea of you have to hold your own with the boys, but you also right. have to let them feel like men or something like that, you know?
Right. And you know, maybe some of that has not changed all that specifically in terms of being a performer of any kind. You know, as a performer, you do have a particular persona. It's why we become so disappointed, you know, when Eric Clapton acts like a fool, you know, and because his persona tells us that he's this genius guitar player, you know, but then in reality, you know, he's an anti-vaxxer. And so what do we do with that? You know, how do we respond to that? I mean, I had the same trouble with Loretta Lynn. You know, she supported Trump and I didn't want Loretta Lynn to support Trump. Mm-hmm. I didn't want, you know, I had trouble with that part of her politics, but her persona on stage is different than that. So yeah, you know, that's just, maybe that's just part of being a performer, that people develop these ideas of who you are supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And then when reality sets in, I think that can disappoint us or shock us or, you know, whatever, embarrass us.
I always thought it was really smart of Dolly Parton to never be explicit about her politics, because yes, I feel like I know people who are convinced that she's basically a Marxist, and then other people who are convinced that she's this, you know, conservative, you know, country lady. And there's textual justification for both of those points of view. I mean,
yes, there absolutely is. But yes, she's been very smart about that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Even if I wish she'd be a little bit more, I don't know. I wish she'd agree with me a little bit more, more vocally, I guess.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, even though she gave $1 million to Vanderbilt Hospital so that the vaccine could be sped up and developed, she's never said vax or anti-vax, you know, she's never. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Hmm. Would you like to read a ballad?
Sure. So this poem goes into a later part of the book where I've combined some stories from my family history as well as some poems about nature. And so this is the beginning of one of the latter sections, which still has some connections to music. Mm-hmm. Ballad. Sycamores jut above a daybreak wet with steam. The groundhogs are making coffee. The heron flies above the tree line, drumstick legs stretched rigid, wing flap on the upbeat like a crooked song wounding the sky. A family of house finches makes a dust bath in the gravels at the end of my driveway. They strum and pluck every shimmering day while the worm entombs, while the bud weeps on the vine. I've been broadcasting seed in memoriam. My mother loved the killdeer. Her mother despised the blue jay, the melancholy of its cries like a wretched old love song hummed over and again.
Thank you. I'd love to ask kind of about that connection between the later material in the book, which is more personal. You mentioned it includes a lot of nature poems. Mm-hmm. What do you feel like, why did you want to put this in the same book with a poem about the Carter family?
Well, the truth is that the girl singer poems, or the poems that were explicitly about women singers or that had some sort of murder ballad feel, those poems were originally going to be a chapbook, you know, a smaller version mm-hmm. of this book. And so I really just didn't have enough other music poems written and ready to go. And so I just decided with the help of my editor that I could make these connections between music and song and nature and my own family, which maybe those connections are only clear to me and maybe not to the reader, but I do see them. And that's one of the things. Also, since both of my parents are now gone, it's been really important to me to remember them in poems. And I wanted to do that. I wanted to remember the musical things that they gave to me, and also how to pay attention to nature, how to work and how to pay attention to nature. My mother loved birds. She loved them. And we would sit on her porch or my porch for hours and just look at our field guides to birds and, you know, watch the birds. And she had a whole kind of circus of crows trained that lived in her neighborhood. And
what?
Yes, yes. And listen, these crows, they've lived there for decades. They still live there because my daughter bought my parents' house after they died. And so my daughter lives there now. And these crows, they just keep staying generation after generation. There's about a core of about eight of them that travel and live together. And so yes, mother started feeding them. And so they would see her come out on the porch and they would start hollering. And also they have really distinct cues for when I would come out of the house or when one of the dogs would come out of the house or when my mother would come out of the house. If you listen carefully, you can hear how different the calls are, you know. Mm-hmm. And also, I know nobody believes this, but they knew my car. So when I would turn the corner to head to my mother's house, I would hear them and see them. One of them would start squawking, and then they would all fly over into her yard when I would drive into the driveway. So, wow. So you know, that connection of being with my mother and talking and listening for birds was important to me. Mm-hmm. So again, that may be a personal connection that maybe readers won't get, but I don't know. I just tried to bring music and vitality to all of the poems.
Yeah. And it feels chronological too, that I imagine the earlier poems, the Girl Singer poems, being kind of from the point of view of you as a child and listening to this music and watching these performers on TV and kind of thinking through what does it mean to be a woman and an artist. Mm-hmm. And then it seems like in the later part of the book, it's sort of you almost performing that role of saying, now this is my turn to, you know, you're not singing country songs, but in a way you are.
Yeah, that's really insightful, Andy. Thank you so much for mentioning that. I hadn't really thought of it that way before. And, you know, that's a great thing about writing a book of poems. Your readers tell you a lot about the poems that you can't see yourself or you don't understand yourself. Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. A lot of the poems are from the point of view of my childhood or when, you know, growing up in Knoxville. And then the later poems are about, I don't know. I just, after my parents died, I got a lot of satisfaction and a lot of soothing qualities. And it sort of quelled my grief to think about birds and to write about birds, you know. So,
Are there kind of nature poets or nature poems that you find yourself kind of returning to over and over?
Yes. Well, in general, I would say, for instance, I like the poems of W.S. Merwin because there's a lot of nature in his poems. But I also just sought out and read poems that had been written about birds, as many as I could find, you know. I think Wendell Berry, who's a Kentucky native Kentuckian, is also very tied up with nature poems, and I've looked to his work as well. I love the work of Robert McFarlane, who is a British writer. He's not a poet, but he writes so beautifully about the natural world. When I found McFarlane's work, which was probably about 5 years ago, I just couldn't get enough. And what he writes about nature is just astonishing. So anybody who wants to read about nature, I would recommend Robert McFarlane as a go-to, even though he's not necessarily a poet. He's a nonfiction writer.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've ever heard that name before. So thanks for the recommendation.
Sure.
Would you like to read Put Upon by Grief?
Yeah. So this illustrates what I was saying before about how kind of grief stricken I was and looking to nature to kind of help deal with that. And I was also unpacking a lot of my mother's things that I had cleaned out from her house so that my daughter could move into her house. And I ended up bringing a lot of those boxes home. And then, of course, I didn't have space for them and they were in the garage for a long time. But that's kind of the genesis of this poem. So this is put upon by grief. And the epigraph is from the poet Robin Becker. And it reads, "My dead, I miss you. Won't you give a sign? Make a joke at my expense?" Put upon by grief. Send us a feather, like the woman who in her worst sorrow begged for a gesture from her beloved dead, and a velvet wisp of wing floated right down to her lap. So the story goes, but we have quit believing. Our traumas have been too brutal. We stand beat up and bruised. Starlings have hijacked our trees. And now the quarrel songs of crows and jays rout from the next ridge. Now the woodpeckers hammer in less hateful climbs. Only mockingbirds appear at ease. Now the unpacking and repacking, now the stacking or hauling away. At dusk, bats plunge into our garages and can't find the way out. House wrens foul our storage boxes with their grassy bowls, their eggs spotted as rotting grapes. Now comes the sweating through a full-tilt panic. Now is the shattering of our unfolding and breaking open. The hawk hunts in our ditches, then hurtles headfirst into our walls. And the glory of it all flutters past us. We miss it and are foregone. Send us a feather.
Thanks for that. That was lovely. It was funny when you were describing the poem before you read it, you said that you were unpacking and you sort of paused before you explained that you were unpacking boxes. And I filled in my head that you were unpacking, you know, your feelings of grief, or you're unpacking your relationship with your mother. And then the fact that you're unpacking her literal possessions was a surprise, but they are sort of one and the same in the end, aren't they? When someone dies.
They are. Yes. It's both literal and figurative. And I remember at the time kind of feeling like I was being betrayed by the birds and the animals, you know, that the little house finch was making all these nests in the garage and making a mess. And then the bats would come in at night and then they couldn't get out. And the crows and the jays had seemed to have left me, you know, and I just felt betrayed in all of my grief. And I know that's not true, but that's sort of how I felt, you know, that I really needed to find a feather to help me feel better.
But that's interesting, because I feel like a lot of nature poetry is very serene, but nature isn't always serene, right? Nature can be annoying and can be a headache.
Yeah. There's a writer who writes about environmental concerns for the New York Times. She's based in Nashville. Her name is Margaret Renkel, R-E-N-K-L. And she talks about that, how she can look out from her office onto her backyard and look and watch nature as it happens, you know. And she had built this, I think it was a bluebird box that she had built and nailed to a tree trunk. And a family had set up shop, you know, in the bluebird box. And then one day she saw a snake climbing up that tree, and she knew that, you know, the eggs were going to get eaten, you know, that's part of nature. That's, you know, the bad and the good. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Marianne Worthington, I've already taken up so much of your time, but thanks so much for being on New Books in Performing Arts to talk about your wonderful collection, The Girl Singer.
Thank you so much for having me, Andy. It was a thrill and an honor to be here. I appreciate it so much.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you were here.